From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Vocalists like the Osmonds and David Archuleta steal the limelight in this town, but there's another pool of artistic talent that's often overlooked. Utah is fertile ground for choral musicians, and there's a chorus for just about everyone. Choirs like the Salt Lake Children's Choir feature bright young voices. Large ensembles like the 360-member Mormon Tabernacle Choir have garnered international acclaim. And there are choruses of every kind in between, from those who perform Renaissance chants to folk tunes to holiday classics. They tackle work from composers both classical and contemporary, and they travel the world sharing their talents. Today on the program, a look at choral music in Utah, plus an update from the Utah State Fair. All that, plus your calls, coming up after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Are you a bass, tenor, alto, or soprano? If you can answer that question, chances are you've sung in a choir. Choral groups are all around us, at school, at church, community. Some choruses require extensive experience and auditions. Others invite anyone with a willing heart and a relatively good sense of pitch. And all of them require time and effort. So, why do so many of us sing here in Utah? And why do local audiences continue to support this performing art in droves? This hour, we're talking about choral music in Utah and why we sing. Joining us this hour, Catherine Reese Newton. She's the music critic for the Salt Lake Tribune. Catherine, welcome.
Good morning.
Also with us, Dennis McCracken, artistic director of the Salt Lake Men's Choir, a 65-member gay men's chorus that's heading into its 30th year. And he's also the organist and administrator for First Baptist Church of Salt Lake City. And Dennis McCracken, thanks so much for getting up early.
Thank you for having us.
Also with us, Dr. Barlow Bradford, visiting professor of choral studies in the School of Music at the University of Utah, where he conducts the University Singers and the a cappella choir. He's also artistic director and co-founder of Utah Chamber Artists, a 45-member mixed chorus celebrating its 21st year. And Barlow Bradford, thanks to you for being here.
Thank you, Jim.
And we'd like to invite you to join the conversation with your questions or comments. Do you sing in a choir? If so, tell us why. 801-355-TALK is the number. 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Catherine Reese Newton, I want to start with you. Any idea how many choirs there are just here along the Wasatch Front?
You know, last night I started making a list just off the top of my head. I came up with 24. I'm sure there are plenty that I've missed.
Why do you think there's such a rich and diverse environment of choral music here?
I think it's been part of our cultural tradition from the beginning. I think it appeals to people because it's a community thing. People can, you know, make something maybe that's more than the sum of the parts. I hope I don't get into trouble here, but I think singing is more intuitive, and so people don't feel that they have to have a lot of training, obviously. You know, there is training if you want to be a good choir, but I think that it's more welcoming to people, I guess.
Better than a solo act. Dennis McCracken, do you have thoughts on why Utah is so has a lot of a talent pool here that's willing to sing?
I think it's part of our heritage here. I also think we start them very young. There's great children's choruses, schools. They move into junior and senior high school. They sing. They move into college. They sing. They get out. They want to keep singing. So it just keeps growing.
And Barlow, thoughts on that?
I would agree with that. I think this idea of it being an inherent instrument is very important. There's something, I think, about singing that is so personal and fulfilling that when people get involved with that, that it almost becomes a necessity for them.
You've been in this marketplace for quite some time. How has the choral environment changed in the time that you've been involved in it?
I'm not sure that numbers have changed. I would say that maybe the directors have changed. Some have gone on doing other things. Others have taken place. One choir will finish up, another starts. I don't know. I guess as I look at what's happened with my own group over time. It's come from having, you know, 100 or 200 people as an audience, and we're really fighting to get these things to work, to a fully professional organization in 20 years' time, which is, it's not an easy thing to do, but it has been fulfilling to watch that change and to watch it develop into a really first-rate musical organization.
Catherine, how have you, what's your perception of the environment? Do you think that choirs are kind of fluid, coming and going all the time? People are starting new choirs, the old choirs mm-hmm. are folding, or is there just a, kind of this mainstay of choral enthusiasts?
Well, you know, you have your institutions like Barlow's group and Dennis's group and the Tabernacle Choir, for example, and there are some choirs that are sort of institutions in that way, and there are some that are sort of personality driven, and as the conductor moves on to something else or retires or whatever, you know, I was thinking about how the J. Welch Chorale evolved and kind of split into two directions. One wanted to do the more serious liturgical, quote-unquote, classical repertoire, and the other one wanted to do the lighter stuff. Things like that aren't uncommon, I think.
Mm-hmm. Dennis McCracken?
Well, I think it keeps growing because I know there's new, like, Salt Lake Choral artists. All of a sudden, they've got a children's choir, a women's choir. They're they've gone from one to four choirs. We're hopefully someday going to start a women's chorus that's the counterpart to the men's chorus. You know, there's just all these opportunities and people waiting to join. So it's kind of it keeps growing, I think.
Can we give this conversation a little bit of broader context? Barlow Bradford, what is the history of choral music? How long have we been singing together in harmonies?
Well, I think singing has been part of the human experience since humans experience. The thing that we know in as far as Western music is concerned is that they were singing it basically in unison for many, many years. This would be in the church services, especially in the, most people know of Gregorian chant. Mm-hmm. This was a unison expression of a particular thought that would be done in the churches. Over time, composers wanted to expand that musical expression, and they started writing, in essence, parallel lines that would go with that. And then over time, these lines started to weave in and out, and it started creating harmonic structure, if you will, and parts came forward, and we started singing in harmony. And I think it's really fulfilling. One thing about the choral situation is that I think that in history it was easier to sing a choral piece than it was to sing a solo. And so you would often find that the amateur singer would be part of the choir, whereas the solo singer would be the one that would step out and be in front of the choir. And I think that as a result, choirs have traditionally been a, quote, amateur organization. Of course, that the level of choirs has risen to become, at their highest, a very, very professional musical organization that could rival any major orchestra in their artistic output.
Hmm. Catherine, do you have something to add to that? You were nodding.
Oh, I was just agreeing with what Barlow said.
Okay. Well, Barlow, in your comments, you mentioned the role of religion in the choral tradition. And I want to play a piece from Utah Chamber Artists. This is a piece from a conductor named Herbert Howell. It's from his Requiem, Psalm 121. Give us a little bit of background, and then we'll play the clip.
This piece is a very personal piece of Herbert Howell's. He wrote this as an expression of grief when his son died as a young boy. And you hear that very personal expression in this. It's for double choir a cappella.
This is Utah Chamber Artists performing Psalm 121.
Thank you.
Barlow Bradford, what do you hear when you are listening to that performance?
What do I hear? First and foremost, I hope I hear a great piece of music, which actually is what I do here. And then I start thinking, well, this note could have possibly been the slightest bit different here, and this vowel could probably be a little different here. But, you know, in general, that's just the curse I live with.
Dennis McCracken.
It's the same thing.
Is that just part of the job of being the conductor? You hear the slight errors?
It is, and especially with your own work. You always – I'm with Barlow. All that vowel could have been whatever this note needed. Yeah, it's really difficult to listen to your own work sometimes. Other people don't hear it the way we do.
That's correct.
Some really lovely voices here. What, as a critic, do you listen for when you are assessing a choir's performance? We're getting the inside scoop for the people who are actually performing. Catherine Reese Newton.
You know, as many times as I am asked that question, you would think that I would have a better answer prepared. Aside from, you know, the technical proficiency of the singers, almost equally important is whether it makes me feel something as a listener.
Do you take into account the reaction of other people in the audience, or not so much?
Not so much.
Do you go into a scene, a performance, with a lot of background? Have you studied up on the pieces, or are you looking for that emotional component and then looking for the background on a piece?
Well, I try to be as familiar with the work being performed as I can. And if it's a new piece, I try to listen to other pieces by that composer or contemporaries, maybe, to give myself kind of a context.
Barlow, you mentioned that in that piece it was for two choirs. So we're talking 16 parts meshing together. How difficult is that to pull off?
Well, in this case, the double choir is probably no more than 10 parts total. It can be very difficult to mesh. With this particular group, they managed to do it, I think, really beautifully. The thing that's difficult, I think, is just learning it to begin with, because there's so much going on, and to make sense of that takes quite a bit of time.
Hmm.
And rehearsal time is always at a premium.
Yeah. Dennis McCracken, how do you select the pieces that Salt Lake Men's Choir performs? What's the process there?
Depends on what we're doing. We try to theme all of our concerts, so then we start looking for things that fit. Tend to be a little bit more, our span of music tends to be a little bit broader than some choirs, because we do a little bit of everything. So what's current, what's new, you know, old things, what we can afford to buy, because music's expensive.
It sure is. Well, let's take a listen. This is the Salt Lake Men's Choir. We're going to head into a break, but on the way out, we're going to listen to your choir performing Stopping by the Woods. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit of background before
Stopping
we
by Woods is from the Frostiana by Randall Thompson, based on the poetry of Robert Frost. And this is probably one of the darker pieces in the suite. So it's a beautiful winter piece.
Salt Lake Men's Choir performing Stopping by Woods. The Salt Lake Men's Choir performing Stopping by Woods. Today on the program, we're talking about singing in a choir. Why does Utah have such a rich choral environment? Do you sing in a choir? We invite you to join the conversation. 801-355-TALK is the number, or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. We need to take a break, but we'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW Salt Lake City.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier Pearson. This is City Views. Today on the program, why Utahns love choirs. If you or a loved one sings in a choir, what's the draw? If you've got questions or comments, call us 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Or you can send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. With us this hour, Dr. Barlow Bradford, a visiting professor of choral studies at the University of Utah, Dennis McCracken, artistic director of the Salt Lake Men's Choir, and Catherine Reese-Newton, music critic for the Salt Lake Tribune. Dennis and Barlow, I'm interested, what's the pull for you personally? How did you get interested and introduced to choral music? Let's start with Barlow Bradford.
My first introduction actually was my mother. She used to conduct our local church choir, and I would go to rehearsals with her when I was very young. Music was always something that I was drawn to. And when I was 16, I was asked to take over our church choir. And so I thought, okay, why not? And started doing that, and I have basically been conducting a choir ever since then. Hmm. It's been many, many years. But I actually started forming my own choirs when I was a teenager and just really, really loved it.
Dennis McCracken, what's the draw?
It's the same way. I grew up in a home where my mother and dad sang together. They sing in a choir. I can remember going to choir practice very young and sitting next to my mother and singing alto with her. I don't ever remember a time when I wasn't in a choir or playing for a choir or singing with a choir or directing.
Catherine Reese-Newton, do you find that is a big component of joining a choir? It's family. It's tradition.
I guess so. My experience has been similar to that of these two gentlemen, although obviously not at the same level.
Do you sing in a choir, I have to ask?
I accompany my church choir right now, but usually I sing from the piano because we won't have enough voices on one part or another.
Bass.
Okay, that one I can't do, but the other three, I'm good.
That's always the case with a church choir. You kind of take what you've got there. I want to get to a few more pieces of music in the time that we've got. Barlow Bradford, I want to play a clip from Mozart's Requiem. This is Confutatis. And tell us about Mozart's process. He composed this in the 18th century.
That's correct.
Why do you think his music holds up so well?
Because he's one of the great geniuses of all time. He's a miracle. He knew exactly what to write and exactly what not to write.
This is a Utah chamber artist performing Confutatis. Catherine Reese-Newton, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I'm going to. What are you hearing as a critic, the critic's ear in this performance? What draws, speaks to you?
Oh, well, you know, obviously, as Barlow said, the Mozart Requiem is one of the greatest pieces ever. I just love how the men's voices kind of move against each other and then the juxtaposition with the serene, you know, the serenity of the women singing. And the orchestra sounds pretty cool, too.
Not an easy piece to pull off, Barlow Bradford.
No, it's not. We, with Utah Chamber Artists, we get one rehearsal for our entire program the night before with our orchestra. And so I always feel like, I'm trying to catch a speeding train. But they're such remarkable musicians that they just sit down and make it work.
From the true classical to another kind of classic, Dennis McCracken, I want to listen to a piece from Salt Lake Men's Choir. It's called Landlord Fill the Flowing Bowl. What can you tell us about this traditional tune?
It's a traditional English carol. During Christmas time, the landlords would invite all of their serfs and the people who work on their farms to come and have a drink in the mansion. And so they would stand outside and sing, and this is a song about that.
Okay, let's take a listen. Salt Lake Men's Choir performing Landlord Fill the Flowing Bowl.
Landlord! Landlord!
Dennis McCracken, as I listen to that, I just can't help but smile. It's fun. And it, maybe that's why another reason why people sing. It's fun.
It is. And, you know, with most choirs, it really is more than just the music. My choir becomes a big family. And there's this sense of belonging to this community where you share a common purpose or a common goal, or that is really more than the music. And when choirs have that, you can hear it in the way they perform. Mm. Whether they're doing the Mozart or doing something like this, or you can hear it in their sound.
We're speaking today about choral music in Utah and the choral music scene. If you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. And let's go to the phones, and I believe it's Karen. Karen joining us from Salt Lake City. Karen, welcome.
Thank you. I belong to two choirs, actually. One is a community choir, South Jordan Community Choir, and then a smaller audition precision group called the Decibels. We sing at nursing homes and senior centers, and once a year we sing at Temple Square. The thing these two choirs have in common is our director, who's Marlene Stanley, who is a force of nature. We've just started our fall programs that lead up into our winter, our Christmas programs. In 110 days, we practice or perform 74. And I don't go to all of those, but Marlene does, and she sets up our programs.
Karen, it's a real commitment of time and effort. Why do you do it?
Well, just the very last thing. First of all, it's such a family, the very last thing that was mentioned, but it's so much fun. Music is good for your energy and good for your spirit, and you get the group all going in the same direction. It's just fun.
Karen, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK. Catherine Reese-Newton, that community component, tell me about that. Are you seeing that when you go and evaluate a performance? Do you see that this is more than just a performance? It's an investment of time. It's a lifestyle.
Hmm. You know, that's one thing I hadn't considered, whether the the dynamic within the group, whether they seem to be friends. But touching on something Dennis said, one important thing is, you know, do I believe them when they're singing? Do I believe they're having fun, as the Salt Lake Men's Choir clearly was in the example we just heard?
Mm. She also mentioned, Karen mentioned, the importance of the director and the enthusiasm and the skill level that that person brings to the group. Thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with what she said, and we have a lot of people with the educational background, the musical background, and the enthusiasm to, you know, to engender the sort of loyalty and participation that. You know, I wasn't familiar with the two choirs that she mentioned. I'm thinking, oh, story idea. And but you know that's typical. There are so many that you know that I don't even know about. I shouldn't say this, but you know they don't need the publicity that's engendered by the Salt Lake Tribune to, you know, they have their following.
Mm-hmm. Karen, thanks for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number. Dennis McCracken, something that you mentioned earlier about, you said as the conductor, you don't get stage fright because you're not facing the audience. But clearly, as Karen mentioned, the director has a direct role in the success of a performance.
Oh, I don't know about stage fright. I think we all get it in some ways. But we don't face the audience. We're facing our choir, and our job is to get them going and enthused and all the little tricks many directors have to get them to do what we need them to do. So our job's a little different. It's work. Some people think you just stand up and flap your arms and that's it, but that's not the case at all. It's work.
We'll talk about the hard part of the job, Barlo Bradford, the work part of it. What makes it fulfilling for you and putting in that extra time and effort to make sure your choir sounds fantastic?
The work part of it is seemingly endless. The fulfillment comes, for me personally, when we have a moment in rehearsal when the light bulb goes on and the whole group seems to at one moment get what we're trying to accomplish. And that's kind of a magical moment. You know, you hope that that also happens on stage when you have an audience there. But in speaking with my choir members, they'll say the same thing, that it seems that those little magic moments in rehearsal are the things that keep them wanting to be there.
Well, let's hear another piece from Utah Chamber Artists. This is A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. Berkeley, I suppose, as they say it. Mm-hmm. Would you like to introduce this piece?
This is, of course, everyone I'm sure knows the tune to this piece. It was arranged by a former professor of mine, Burnell Hales, from the University of Utah. And I'm not sure how many people even have this manuscript. It's one that he happened to have given to me, and so we've performed it.
Okay, let's take a listen. Utah Chamber Artists performing A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. Chamber Artist performing A Nightingale Sang in Berkeley Square. Barlo Bradford, what's the trick to blending? How do you get so many disparate voices, different kinds of vocal tones meshing together and sounding as one?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's one that comes out clearly in this particular piece. I think there are a couple of things to it. One, you have to pick the right voices to begin with when people come and audition for you. You get the certain voices. They may be a fantastic voice, and you're going to say, you know what, that's not really for this particular color that we're after in this choir. Beyond that, it's defining a sound clearly in your head as a conductor, being able to put that across to your group, and then you have your vowels to match that. And if everyone's matching their vowel and they match their pitch, that's, you know, 90% of the battle right there.
Mm. Denim McCracken, tricks to making it sound unified.
Work. It's work.
Practice, practice, practice.
Practice, practice. Yep. And I always say, I don't even remember which conductor I stole it from, practice doesn't make perfect, practice makes permanent.
Mm.
And it's a lot more than just singing the piece. It's the way you warm up and how you do that sort of work. It's constant. You're always having to remind them about vowels and listen. And it's just, it's a whole process. It's like playing an instrument, too. I know, it's learning how to finger and do all those sort of things. It's the same principle.
Mm-hmm. Karen, our caller, mentioned a phenomenal number of rehearsals.
Oh, my.
Over 70.
74 performances in 110 days? That's murder.
That's serious commitment. Are you seeing choirs performing constantly? I mean, Catherine Reese-Newton, the schedule, you said it was during the performance season that it gets really tight. Mm-hmm. How many concerts are you attending a week? What kind of music are you hearing?
Oh, well, you know, I don't just write about choral music, mm-hmm. so, you know, I'd have to look at my calendar to, you know, count them up. But I've got one coming up next Monday.
Speaking of that, Barlow Bradford, Utah Chamber Artist, having a concert. A couple of concerts at the Cathedral of the Madeleine coming up.
Correct.
What can you give us a sneak peek?
Any concert in that building is an event. This particular one, I think, is going to be a very special event. We try to utilize the beauties of this building in this concert. One thing we're doing this year, which I've never seen done there, is we are lighting the stained glass windows in that building from the outside so that our concert goers will sit there and they will see these windows lit up as we're doing the concert. And our program actually follows the story of those windows, which is kind of a neat experience to be there, to see, to hear in that ambiance. The acoustic there is quite special.
Mm.
Be an exciting concert and one that you just cannot get on a CD.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You have to be there.
Do you agree with that, Dennis?
That
the live performance
is
conveys something that you cannot get
absolutely
in the car.
Because when you're listening to a CD, you don't see the faces. You don't see the animation of the singers. You don't see their excitement. You might hear some of it, but it's not the same as being there. And the sound's not the same.
Tell me this, Dennis McCracken, your group, Salt Lake Men's Choir, has a new CD coming out.
We do.
Did you perform it live or did you perform in a studio?
No, we actually recorded it at First Baptist Church just 3 weeks ago.
And how is that different from having live bodies out in an audience who you're connecting with?
There's an excitement when a chorus goes on in front of an audience. And you don't get that when you don't have an audience. You don't have that in reaction. So I kept having to say, all right, close your eyes and pretend all of your friends and your family are sitting out here. Now sing it to me. And that helped a lot. But there's just a great difference when there's not an audience reaction. I mean, the other reason people do this is because they like the applause. They like the attention. They like the... So when that's not there, the energy level is a little different.
And I imagine as the critic, Catherine Reese-Newton, that being there is so different from being removed and not seeing the facial expressions and the gestures and the conductor and the orchestra or whatever.
Right. There's nothing like being in the moment together.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play another piece from the Salt Lake Men's Choir. It is called All My Heart. Dennis McCracken, can you give us a heads up on what
it's,
this piece is?
Fairly modern piece by... Z. Randall Stroop, I believe is how his name is pronounced. He's done some beautiful choral work. He does a lot of real fun harmony stuff. And so we took his SATB arrangement and rearranged it for men's chorus.
Okay. This is Salt Lake Men's Chorus singing All My Heart.
Oh,
the Salt Lake Men's Choir, singing All My Heart. Dennis McCracken, as you're listening to that, you're smiling.
Well, I just enjoy it. It's a great piece, and we've had a lot of fun with it.
This email from Lisa in Salt Lake City, who writes, "Music is such an important part of my life. I'm thrilled to be a new member of the Utah Chamber Artists." And she says, unlike other forms of music, choral music touches my soul in a way that I can't describe. You feel connected to the human spirit. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Barlow Bradford from Utah Chamber Artists, as well as the University of Utah School of Music. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jen.
Also, Dennis McCracken, Artistic Director of the Salt Lake Men's Choir. Thanks to you.
Oh, thank you.
And Catherine Reese Newton, copy editor and music critic for the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
We need to take another break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. If you've got a hankering for chocolate-covered scorpions or you want to pet a pig, it's not too late. The Utah State Fair continues through the weekend, and joining me now to talk about the fair is Utah State Fair Park Executive Director Clark Karras. Clark, thanks so much for being with us.
How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Oh, just other than a little bit hoarse because I was, I think I was singing too loud last night during Casey and the Sunshine Band. It brought back way too many memories.
It was like
time travel.
Now, this is your first Utah State Fair as executive director, but you've been going to fairs since you were a kid growing up just outside Spanish Fork. The fair is very personal for you, isn't it?
It is. Those 65 acres out there are kind of sacred to me. That's how I paid for my education, and every September was kind of like a second Christmas to me and my family.
So why do people go to the fair these days?
You know, what they're finding is people want to return to their roots. They want to go home, and they want to go back and experience, you know, we've got a bunch of baby boomers on the tail end of that who you know, they had a grandma or a grandpa or even mom and dad that were raised on a farm and had that farm experience. And we don't have that. We're kind of on the tail end of that now. And kind of the fun thing for the last few days of the state fair is this morning all of the 4-H and FFA kids, Future Farmers of America, are weighing their animals in. It's kind of a fun process. An interesting process, but they're weighing their animals in, and over the next couple of 3 days, you know, kind of the cream of the crop of young people will be at the Utah State Fair with their market hogs, their market lambs, their market steers, and the projects that actually will end up paying for their educations, their LDS missions, and different things over the next several years.
So there really is, at the heart of the fair, this educational component, reconnecting with our rural heritage, but also there's a practical one. You can make some money.
You can. Even with Grandma's Pickles, you can make a little bit of money. And this Friday night will be the annual governor's contest. This year we chose it to be meatloaf because Governor Herbert actually is a meatloaf connoisseur. And we've got all kinds of entries, and somebody will be able to go home with about $175 on the best meatloaf at the Utah State Fair.
Wow. Not everyone can say that. We're speaking with Clark Karras. He's the executive director of the Utah State Fair. If you've got questions about the fair, if you want some inside scoop, call us, 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or you can drop us an email at cityviews@kcpw.org. You mentioned meatloaf. State fairs are known for their cuisine. And some of it's rather unusual. What's the strangest thing that you've eaten over the past week and a half?
Truthfully, I don't know if I can say it. What are those seven words you get? No. The maggot melt sandwich.
Maggot melt sandwich.
Yes. It's actually, supposedly they're Indonesian grubs that have been deep fried, placed on buns with cheese on each side, and they're a bit crunchy. Probably the best thing that I've eaten this year, though, in terms of, quote, fair food, is the deep-fried Twinkie stuffed with bacon. Tastes a tiny bit like a Monte Cristo sandwich.
It's the bacon, right?
It is. You know, bacon makes anything taste good. I mean, and with all those 4-H kids today entering their pigs, you know, there's going to be plenty of bacon in Utah for the next year.
How is attendance so far this year stacking up to previous years at the fair?
We had, you know, the opening day was the biggest day that we had had. The past biggest day was about 13,000. We had 16,700 the opening day. And ever since then, it's been a really, really steady stream of folks. You know, we're expecting that we hopefully, last year we had 297,000 folks, and this year we're hoping for 300,000.
Mm. Has anything changed? Any new attractions this year that you introduced and thought, you know, this needs to be in our state fair park?
Not really. I mean, other than we did fireworks on Sunday night on Patriot Day. My feeling was that on that day, you know, with the Star Spangled Banner, you've got the words through the rocket's red glare, and, you know, I mean, it let people know we were still here. It's one of the first times that we have done fireworks, but otherwise, it's pretty much... it's the same, but it's, you know, but that's what people are looking for. I mean, when people walk through those gates, they're kind of looking for a normalcy, and they're looking to be able to set everything behind. And the thing for me that is fun about the fair or any fair, you walk around the grounds and everybody has a smile on their face. It's, if it's the smell of a certain food, if it's a ride, you know, if it's certain animals that, you know, watching the children play with the goats, we actually, yesterday we had a really special experience. We had one of the dairy cows give birth.
Mm.
And, so there's a baby calf out there for everybody to see. And, you know, it's not necessarily, it doesn't get the coverage that when Shamu or, you know, SeaWorld, you know, a killer whale gives birth. But there were kids there yesterday that saw a baby calf born.
That's not something you see every day, and especially here in the city.
It's not. And that's what, you know, truly that's what we hope to bring back to people. You know, yesterday morning the carnival was open for 2 hours prior to its regular opening for special needs children and folks. You know, the fair is there. You know, it's like I told a little girl yesterday. She said, "Do you own the fair?" And I said, "No, you do." I mean, it truly, the fair is for the people.
Mm. The State Fair Park in previous years has had some financial difficulties. I'm wondering, Clark Harris, how things stand right now. Is the State Fair financially healthy and viable?
Oh, yeah. For the last, the State Fair for the last 5 years has made a profit. You know, in terms of, there's really no financial difficulty. The Utah State Fair Park, you know, I tell a lot of people, they think we're kind of like Brigadoon. We appear once a year for 11 days and disappear. Well, that's not necessarily true. There are concerts, there are rodeos, there are quinceañeras. We've kind of become the unofficial cultural center for our Latin and Hispanic community, which on Saturday, September 17th, we'll celebrate Fiesta Mexicana. You know, I mean, we're honored that this is the third year that we will celebrate officially at the Utah State Fair Park Mexican Independence Day. But the Utah State Fair actually has been in the black, and it will be in the black. It's just that a lot of people fail to remember that we're there, and that's actually one of our goals, is to make sure people do remember we're not Brigadoon. We don't appear for 11 days a year and then disappear.
And that's interesting to me that it is expanding beyond the traditional definition of what the state fair is, that you can bring in different cultural traditions and integrate it as part of the fair experience.
Well, we are the Utah State Fair Park, and, we're open every day of the year. People, one of the things that I enjoy is looking out the window of my office and seeing people riding their bikes through the fair park, walking their dogs. Since I came there in April, we've had several weddings. In the grandstands, we've had boxing matches. And almost every weekend, you have either a quinceañera. Well, actually, 2 weekends ago, there was a quinceañera, a wedding, and a birthday party. Mm. And by the end of the night, they had all started to mix, and everybody was one big family.
We're speaking with Clark Harris, the executive director of the Utah State Fair Park. You mentioned earlier livestock and the competitions there. How tough is the competition going between prize cows, turkeys, my personal favorite, the rabbits? How do you judge what the quality of an animal is?
A lot of it is if you just look at the animal and you think, that actually is a really, really beautiful animal, then you're on your way. Mm. A lot of it has to do with there are certain breeds, say with sheep, there are certain breeds that are specifically for wool, for suits, for carpets. I mean, they're what we call the white face. And then there are certain breeds that are specific to when you go to your, local restaurant and you order lamb chops. And, they tend to be a much taller animal, a much longer animal, so that there's a lot more lean meat on the animal. The same with beef, but then, the really interesting thing is that with the dairy cattle that come to the fair, they still have to be milked every day. And the interesting thing about that is that we do have a container that is FDA approved that the milk goes into. And it's actually used to make ice cream, is sold and actually used to make ice cream, because you do have to milk those cows every day.
We've only got about a minute left, Clark Harris, but give us a preview of the final weekend coming up of the Utah State Fair. What are the highlights?
One of the real highlights is the Midtown Men tomorrow night, Friday night. They actually are four of the original members of the cast of the Jersey Boys, Tony Award-winning musical. And then, like I said, Saturday on the 17th is Fiesta Mexicana, which, as I said, we're honored to host that celebration. And then on Sunday, we have the Demolition Derby, which is, they've become so popular throughout the state, they sell out everywhere. So we just hope people go to www.utahstatefair.com. And there are still deals to be had and, reduced prices.
Clark Harris, Executive Director of the Utah State Fair. Thanks very much for the time, and we'll put a link up on our website, kcpw.org.
Thank you, Jennifer.
City Views is a production of KCPW News with help from Eric Ray and Jesse Ellis. Ryan Cron composed our theme music. And you can continue the discussion online at kcpw.org. Tomorrow, it's Politics Up Close with Jeff Robinson. Hope you'll tune in then. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce.